Hi, this is Rum Buentadura. What I want to talk about today is what happens when you've just tested a new technology. Could be that you've decided to put a whole new content management system in place and move all your courses to that. Could be that you've decided to start using clickers for audience feedback in the classroom. And the end of the term comes around and you've got results, and maybe they're good, maybe they're bad, but so what really caused it? I mean, is it really the fact that you had the clickers, say, in the classroom, and that really improved students' grades, assuming they improved? Or was it simply that the students just liked having a nice new toy in their hands, and because of that they were happier with the class, and because of that they put in a little more effort, and that's what made their grades go up? Well, this whole issue is the issue of expectation effects, and that's the topic for today's talk. In other words, what they are, how to identify them, and what to do or how to, you know, proceed when you come across them. So if you're looking at the slides, you should now move on to the second slide. The first thing we're going to do is look at four different types of expectation effects. And if you read the literature, you're going to find tons more than just four basic types. But I think that four types cover most of the range of what you're likely to encounter, the most important, most crucial effects. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see the first thing I want to talk about are the placebo and halo effects. And while these are different effects, I group them together, and we'll get in a second to why you do that. Now, the placebo effect is the idea that you have somebody interacting with something. And usually you think of this in terms of medicine, right? So they take a pill, and because they think the pill is going to do something, the pill actually does have an effect, even if it turns out to just be sugar. That's the placebo effect. And it's very important to note that it's not just they think it has an effect upon them. No, they think it's going to do something for them, preferably something good. Therefore, it has a real effect upon them. It's very, very important to realize that the effect is quite real. When somebody takes a sugar pill and reports decreased pain, assume it's somebody with chronic arthritis problems, right? If they report decreased pain, you can actually test for this. There are standard pain scales, and sure enough, their pain experience has decreased. In some cases, for instance, where placebo surgery has been performed for certain types of coronary surgery, and the patient actually gets better. Again, you can measure the pumping capability of the heart. You can measure, you know, how well they're doing, and they are doing objectively better. So, in fact, it's very important to think of placebo effects as real effects. And when you're thinking of placebo effects in the context of technology, it's not so much a question of sugar pill. There's nothing quite like a sugar pill in technology, right? The only case you could come up with would be maybe the joke from Dilbert about giving the pointy-haired boss an Etch-a-Sketch instead of a real laptop. But beyond that, there's no real sugar pill. But there can be an effect whereby somebody thinks this technology will help me do X. And independently of whether that technology would actually help them do X, because they think it will help them do X, they actually do get that result out of it. Now, that's the placebo effect. And similarly, the other effect you have here is the halo effect. Now, the halo effect is a little different. The halo effect was first identified by Thorndike in the 20s, and he was looking at what soldiers had to say about their commanding officers. And what Thorndike found was that positive properties of the commanding officer in one arena tinged how the soldiers evaluated the commanding officer in another arena. So in the area of technology, if a technology has a certain coolness factor associated with it, regardless of whether that coolness factor really applies to intended uses of the technology, it will tinge perception of the technology. And a perfect example these days is the iPod. anything you do with an iPod, because the iPod is perceived to be cool, doing something with an iPod will have a certain halo effect that will not be obtained by other similar technologies. So, for instance, if you do, say, cassette tapes to listen to language lessons versus using the iPod to do language lessons, and you don't use really any of the built-in features of the iPod will still have a certain halo effect in its perception as being cooler and therefore somehow better than the cassette tapes. And therefore, in turn, you're very likely to observe improved results with the iPod, even though it's not really an intrinsic issue with the iPod technology, but much more the sort of halo effect. Now, the reason I group together the placebo and halo effects is that in actual practice, it's very hard to separate out the two with technologies. In other words, how somebody perceives a technology intrinsically is not separable from halo effects of the technology. And in terms of what you encounter in teaching practice, you might as well think of these two together. Yeah? So this is the first one of the effects I wanted to look at. Now, the second expectation effect I wanted to talk about, if you look at the next slide, is the Hawthorne effect. And the Hawthorne effect gets its name from the fact that it came up or was discovered through studies that were conducted at Western Electric's Hawthorne plant, which ran starting around 1924 through around 1936. And there were a series of experiments, but I'll give you the summary of the best known one, which is the following. The experimenters decided to say, okay, I wonder if changing the light level in the factory will improve worker productivity. So you turn up the light level, and sure enough, worker productivity goes up. Great. But here's what happens next. You'd say, well, okay, so this is a result of the change in the light level. You turn down the light level, and what happens to productivity? You'd hope it goes down. Nope, it goes up. And it turns out, throughout these experiments, that what you found and what the researchers here were, Ruffensperger, Dixon, and Mayo, what they found was that, well, actually it didn't have anything to do with the light level. It had to do with the fact that people were exposed to a technological shift, in this case manifested in the light level, and that by itself affected how they perform. Again, I keep coming back to the idea of these are objective effects. It isn't that people thought they were more productive with the lights up or with the lights down. No, you could measure, okay, by piece how productive they were, and sure enough, their productivity actually increased. So this effect, it was called the Hawthorne effect, actually quite a few years after the studies were done, and it refers to the fact that if you introduce a new technology, you are effectively likely to get some shift, typically positive, in terms of productivity. Now, there's lots of reasons why this might be the case, but let me give you one of the simplest ones. One of the simplest ones is you have a worker in a factory that feels pretty much like they're on their own. And now the boss, the manager, does something to say, well, we're changing things a little bit with a positive expectation, right? Well, in that case, the worker says, gee, you care about me. And consequently, you have an increase in productivity levels. And you'll get very much the same type of effect with students. Students who have been seeing, you know, for many of their courses, the same old lecture with a distance from the presenter, no questions asked, and so on. You suddenly have somebody use more interactive technology, such as the clicker, and suddenly you're getting something that is very likely to produce a Hawthorne effect, because the students are saying, ah, this professor cares enough to use a clicker. So that's the Hawthorne effect. Now, I should pause for a second and mention that there is some discussion as to the magnitude of both, in the previous case, placebo effects as well as Hawthorne effects. And some people have gone as far as to say there is no such thing as a placebo effect. there is no such thing as a Hawthorne effect. You're seeing something else altogether. It's just an error in measurement, an error in how you're doing the statistics, and so on. I would argue that the best research to date says that, in fact, there do exist clearly placebo effects, and there really do exist Hawthorne effects, although the magnitude estimated in the original studies that led to both may not be quite what the original researchers thought they were. But the existence of the effects themselves, I think, is pretty solid at this stage of the game. Okay, so that's the first two. The third one, I think, is worthwhile mentioning because it's one of those that sometimes people don't think about. It's what's called the John Henry effect. And this name was based upon a study done by Shep and Irvine, back in 1970. John Henry is one of the popular folk figures in American folk mythology. And the story goes that John Henry was a former slave who then was working for the railroad company. There are several versions of the story. And then one day they were going to bring in a steam drill to do the same job he did, you know, making holes for a, you know, drilling through mountains, etc., for the railroad. And John Henry basically challenged the steam drill to a duel, and John Henry won, although in the process he got a heart attack and died. There's other versions of the story that have him driving stakes and versus a mechanical stake driver, but the moral of the story is always the same. You know, it's this individual who, when challenged vis-a-vis a technology, says, "I'm better than the technology," and then goes all out to prove it. And the effect has been observed that sometimes when you run two classrooms and one classroom gets the nice new technology and the other one doesn't, for a variety of factors, if the information gets out, you'll have students saying, I can do just as well as those guys with the nice new technology. And suddenly what you have is the group that you thought was going to be your control group in terms of comparing with the technology suddenly starts doing spectacularly well compared to previous results because of this effect, because of the John Henry effect. And again, in any situation where you're running a control group versus another group with a new technology, it is important to keep it in mind and look for it. And finally, if you go to the next slide, the last effect is a little different, and it's what's been called the Pygmalion effect, after George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion. And I don't know if people here remember that in Pygmalion, not so much My Fair Lady. Part of the issue is that Henry Higgins will always have Eliza behave as a flower girl with him because he always thinks of her as a flower girl. But since the colonel thinks of her as a grand dame, she will behave with him as a grand dame. So this is the genesis of the name, and the effect was observed by Rosenthal and Jacobson in the late 60s. And the effect goes as follows. What they observed was the following. You had a group of teachers, and some of the teachers were told, these students have unusually high IQs. And other teachers were told, these students are not of unusually high IQs. As unbeknownst to the teachers, in fact, the students were chosen at random. In other words, there was absolutely nothing special about the IQ of the students prior to entering the groups. The interesting thing was that after the teachers had interacted with the students for some time, you tested the IQ scores, again, an objective measure, and guess what? The students with the teachers who had been told expect the best from these students have higher IQ scores. The students that have been told, whose teachers have been told don't expect very much from these students, have lower IQ scores. In other words, this effect, the expectation of the teacher, the expectation of the instructor, have a very direct effect on how the students perform. And this effect has been measured over and over and over again. In a recent paper by Rosenthal, he literally claims hundreds of studies have verified this. And again, it's extremely important because you have a new technology and you have one person that has very high expectations for that technology. Okay, so let's stay with the clickers for a second. So you have this faculty member, let's say they're teaching chemistry and they're using the clickers, and they expect that because of the clicker, students will be able to stay on top of things they don't understand, correct errors right away, and so on. And you have another faculty member who's been told to use the clickers but has no expectation. They just think that this is, you know, fancy dressing that does nothing good for the classroom. So all they do is they use the clickers, but clearly in their demeanor, how they treat their students, etc., it's clear they don't expect very much. Well, if at the end of the day, the first professor posts much higher scores than the second professor, yes, it may be that the clickers are having a direct effect, but this may also be a result of the Pygmalion effect. In other words, it's less the clickers and more the expectations of the teachers being passed on to the students. So these are the four major categories of expectation effects that I wanted to talk about today. And as I say, if you go to the literature, there are many other categories, subcategories, shading on these four groupings, etc. But I think these four work for, you know, 90% of the work you have to do in terms of evaluating what happens with new technologies. Moving along then, now that we've established what we're talking about when we're talking about expectation effects, I'd like to start talking now about how you control for expectation effects. Now, controlling for expectation effects doesn't necessarily mean you get rid of expectation effects. Rather, you figure out if they're present, when they're present, and, as we're going to see, so how much of the observed effect do they seem to account for. But you can't get rid of them in the same way that you can get rid of some of the effects in other areas, because, you know, you can't get rid of some of the causes. So it's very important to realize that this is not an issue of minimization. It's an issue of identification and understanding what that identification means. So going on to the next slide, it should be our top tools for research. And these are five items that are what I would call relatively easy ways to say, well, okay, how do I start gathering data that tells me whether this type of expectation effect is present or not? The first one is to try to have multiple instructors use the technology. This is for very simple reasons. If you think about what I just mentioned, for instance, with the Pygmalion effect, if every instructor that uses the technology, regardless of their approach, and we'll come back to that regardless in a little bit, is getting pretty much the same results, that's encouraging. Okay? That seems to indicate that there may be something in this technology that goes beyond expectation effects that is causing, say, classroom results to do better. When you have just one instructor, you're much more susceptible to both John Henry effect as well as lacking clear ways of seeing what's going on with the Pygmalion effect. Second aspect is the counterpart to that, which is try to have multiple classes use the technology. And if you can have multiple instructors and multiple classes, so if, in other words, if you have something like, say, an intro to sociology, and the same person teaches different sections using the technology, you're in measurement heaven. Because now you can start controlling for the effects of different populations. This is ideal if you're in a situation, for instance, as might occur in a community college, where your population in the morning classes may be, you know, students who are relatively fresh out of high school, but your population in the evening classes are older learners, which, again, gives you a good differential to start seeing what's happening in these scenarios. A third tool for research is to have a third party observe the instructors and the classes. Now, you have to be careful here. If you have a very obnoxious observer, and by obnoxious I mean the person is obnoxious, but their presence is blatantly obvious to everybody at every point, you're going to be biasing the results just by the presence of that observer in ways that may not be easily reparable without investing huge amounts of resources into additional controls. So preferably what you want is a relatively neutral observer. In other words, somebody who's there who can observe, take notes, interact, but nobody really realizes, preferably, that they're there, even if they know that they are. So this can help you because this person can latch on right away to attitudinal aspects. Again, think of the iPod scenario I discussed earlier. This is a person who can speak to people about the iPod, and they can hear if the persons are saying, man, I don't care what we do with it, but the iPods are so cool. Well, that's telling you something right off the bat. The party can also observe and see, well, this instructor is saying, now listen, I want you guys to use the clicker to give me feedback, versus somebody who's saying, okay, let's use the clickers again. Again, this is something that might not be readily available unless you have a third party observing. A fourth aspect is look for trends in class performance during a term. And this is important because sometimes if you just use the end of term indicator, you might not have all the information at your fingertips. What do I mean by trends? Well, here's a dead giveaway for a trend that's telling you something. A trend that might tell you something is the fact that you have a class, you introduce a technology, and on the first exam, scores are through the roof. Great, looks great. Second exam, scores are higher, but not as high. Third exam, scores are the same as they were last year. Now, you take the average for the entire course, and it's going to look like, hey, there was a really good effect because scores on average went higher. But if you look at the trend, that's telling you a different story. That trend is saying, you know, for some reason, whatever this technology was doing at the outset, it started doing it less and then subsequently less. And this tends to be a characteristic of many expectation effects. In other words, they tend to taper off over time. So looking at trends in terms of measures of what's going on in the course throughout the term can tell you a lot without having to wait for the end of the term average and, as I say, get at data that would otherwise be obscured. And the final item I'm going to recommend is to use end-of-term attitudinal surveys. Now, several things here. First, why attitudinal surveys? Second, why end-of-term? Okay, attitudinal surveys, because attitudinal surveys allow you to get at data that isn't available from test scores, and that, to be perfectly frank, is usually not available even in student course evaluations. In other words, this allows you to say, well, what were both students' and instructors' attitudes towards the technology? Friendly? Hostile? If you design your questionnaire correctly, you may even be able to get subtly out of it why the technology was viewed in a friendly or hostile way. You may be able to get at issues such as perceptions of interaction of the between the technology and the course. In other words, where people thought it was essential or icing on the cake. This is data that's not easily available otherwise. But you have to design the surveys carefully, of course. Why end of term? Because if you do beginning of term, you tend to load things up front in ways that you really, really don't want to do. So even though it's easier to get higher response rates at the beginning of term than at the end of term, believe me, I've done this many times, and I know the problem. End of term, everybody just wants to get out the door and is not that thrilled about filling out one more survey. Still, you risk doing damage to the procedure by sort of, if you will, tipping your hand too much with a beginning of term attitudinal survey. There's also a couple of other things, such as there's a difference between what people might have heard through the grapevine and the experience they get from even the first half hour of interaction with the technology. So again, a beginning of term attitudinal survey frequently doesn't give you as much useful information and can cause some problems. These are the easiest tools for research. There are others I haven't mentioned, and you have the bibliography at the end of these slides that will give you some additional ideas. One, for instance, that is very, very useful, if you can work out the necessary logistics, is to have students keep diaries throughout the course. Again, you have to get into what do you want them to keep in the diaries, what will you want them to keep their reflections upon technology, things along the lines of how many hours did you really use the technology versus how many you thought you were going to use them, when did you have breakthroughs in understanding things for the course, etc. Some of the information you can get in this way is absolutely invaluable, and again, can help you very quickly pinpoint whether you're dealing with expectation effects or real effects from the technology. But, and here's the big but coming in, to do this properly, you have to have some way of excluding those students that you ask to keep diaries from the end result. Why? Because unfortunately, by asking them to do this, you have also created a population of unusually self-aware students. Now, if it's two students in a class of 100, it's unlikely you're going to skew the final result that much in terms of what the final scores are. But if you have five students in a class of 15, yeah, I can guarantee you're going to skew the final results for the class based upon what you're asking these students to do. So in those scenarios, you have to deal with what is called sometimes a sacrificial population. In other words, you sacrifice the scores for these students in exchange for being able to get their diaries in your analysis of the information. I didn't include this in the basic tools for research because, as you can see, it's more involved and trickier to implement. Let's go on to the next slide, which is experimental design. Now, this slide is taken straight out of Rosenthal and Jacobson's work. And I've decided to retain their terminology, even though I might choose to change it in some instances, but I've chosen to retain it just for the sake of ease of comparison with bibliography and the online literature. And the idea is the following. You say, okay, so far we've been talking about basic tools for research that allow you to look for the possibility of expectation effects. But let's say we want to actually quantify what's going on. We want to go beyond, we think there is or there is not an expectation effect here. And instead you'd like to say, well, I think there's a small, medium, large expectation effect, and I think there's a small, medium, or large technology effect. How do you do this? Okay, what you need to look at is this type of experimental design. And the design here, you'll notice, has two sides. One side that effectively deals, if you will, with the expectations of the class, and another side that deals with the expectations of the teacher. On the side of the expectations of the teacher, you can have teachers, instructors that expect the technology to benefit the classroom or the technology to not benefit the classroom. And this is something that, as we're going to see in a second, you can either stimulate or try to get directly from attitudinal information. And in terms of the classroom, you would like to ideally have three different types of groups. Let's look at group number 30 first. That's the group that gets the new technology. In other words, that's the one that gets the what we're calling here the experimental procedure. Group 1 is the exact opposite. It's the one that gets no technology. So that's the, if we were talking about teaching a course, in group 1, the course would be taught with the old technology or not the new technology. In group 3, the course would be taught with the new technology. Fine, so those two are fairly self-evident. What's group number 2? Well, group number 2 is what Rosenthal and Jacobson called the Hawthorne control. And the Hawthorne control is a group that gets a change that is superficially of similar magnitude to the one that group 3 got, but that in effect cannot have the same technological type of impact intrinsically that group 3 is getting. So to put it concretely, you might be looking at the following. Group 1 is the lecture class taught as always. Group 3 is the lecture class taught with clickers. And group 2 is the lecture class but taught with a suggestion box for people after each lecture to put in a little slip of paper saying what they liked and didn't like about the lecture. So we've made a change, okay, but it cannot occupy the same technological space as the clickers, but it's likely to be perceived in more ways than one as of equivalent magnitude to the clickers. So that's what you're looking at here in this design. Now, this gives you, this matrix gives you that you need six separate groups labeled here A through F to do the complete comparison. A quick side remark, by the way, this experimental design gets rid of many of the problems that have been brought up in analyses of prior work on either placebo effect or Hawthorne effect. So aside from everything else, this also takes into account some of the critiques in a positive way. But the trouble is, six groups is difficult and, frankly, frequently very expensive to get. So I've tried to rank these in terms of degree of importance to how certain you want to be of your final results. The ones that are labeled essential, which are A and E, are the ones you really have to have. If you're going to be serious about quantifying the effects of a technology and to have some idea of expectation effects, you have to have at least one classroom that has the technology and one classroom that doesn't have the technology. Now, fortunately, even if you don't have this in the same year, you can usually work across years. In other words, if you have some reasonable expectation of stability, all other things being equal across years, you can say, well, I'll use this year's class, which got the clickers, let's stay with the clicker example, as group E, and I'll use last year's class, which didn't get the clickers, as group A. There is something you have to be careful though. Many instructors, when they introduce a new technology, will also introduce new forms of evaluation. That's what we call in the trade cheating. It's not that it may be wrong. In other words, they may be absolutely correct to introduce new forms of evaluation. They may be better forms of evaluation. But then you can't compare the two groups. In other words, you can't say, well, I've introduced a new technology, and, oh, now I'm asking for things that in my evaluation that are reinforced by the new technology, but not by for other things that I used to ask for before. Well, you're comparing apples and oranges. So in those scenarios, you can't use historical data. Other ways of getting at the AE groups can also be to go across institutions. If you have two institutions in an area that are willing to share results, and then again, you can look at the historical record and say, yes, their populations, results, etc., are pretty comparable. You can use one as the A group, you can use the other as the E group. So those are essential if you're going to prove anything about magnitude of experimental the effect and what's going on in terms of technology's intrinsic benefits versus expectation effects. Now, if you want to really start getting at the expectation effects, you need to add groups B and C. B is saying you have a control, okay, but the control here is that you have a faculty member that doesn't expect any benefit and is not doing anything with the technology, okay? And you also have a group, this is the one I mentioned before, that instead of getting the clickers, is getting the recommendation cards. This now is beginning to allow you to establish how much you have here of a Pygmalion effect and how much you have here of Hawthorne and or placebo effects. The fact that it says Hawthorne control is a bit of a misnomer. It really is also a good control for placebo, halo, other effects. Finally, if you can afford it, you have the desirable group, and that's DNF, which completes the matrix, and I think that's pretty much self-explanatory. You could at any point replace B, for instance, with F. So if you wanted to do it, say, using groups A, E, C, and F, that would also be a perfectly acceptable experimental design, but it's usually a little easier to get B than F. I mentioned before that there's a question of how you get the professor that thinks there's no benefit to the technology. One way of doing it is to deliberately tell them, look, we're introducing this, but frankly, we don't think there'll be an effect in terms of what you see in the classroom. that has advantages and disadvantages. If the professor believes this, you have a very clear indicator of what their personal expectation is. The disadvantage is that if you actually do expect this technology to present benefits, you're misleading the professor. And different institutions will have different standards according to whether this falls reasonably within the sphere of what you can expect for informed consent in an experiment or not. I'm just going to say that this is the point at which you check with your human subjects research board and hope that they're reasonable about this type of question. If you're not going to do it that way, however, the other way to do this is to simply get it from attitudinal surveys. And then you may not have something as clear-cut as one professor thinks this is great, another one that thinks this is terrible. But you may be able to get shadings, and then you can compare across the shadings. Did the professor have a better expectation, in fact, overall get better results than the one that had lower expectations or not? And that, again, allows you to begin to estimate the size of expectation effects. Okay. So the survey understand the matrix here, because we're going to use it then in the next slide. So you run these groups, and each of them gets different scores. Some do better, some do worse, and you're trying to estimate the size of the effect. Are you looking at something that's a really big effect or at something that's a kind of more moderate effect? If you go to the next slide, I'm going to show you what I think is the simplest way of providing a good estimator of effect size. And this is Cohen's effect size index, which he called D, very descriptive name. And you can see that the effect size index is a rather simple statistical descriptor. You have on top the absolute value of the difference between the mean scores for the two groups being compared. In other words, if one classroom on average scored, say, 80, for the course, and the other class on average scored 70 for the course, then this would be 80 minus 70 gives you 10, okay? And what Bremer we're going to be trying to do is compare the groups in the matrix that we looked at on the previous slide. Now, that's the numerator. The denominator allows you to standardize this by using the standard deviation for each of the groups. And what you're looking here at here is the root mean square average of the standard deviation for the two groups. Now, for those of you whose statistics may be a little rusty, remember that the standard deviation, it tells you essentially how spread out something is. Okay, that's one way of looking at this. So what you're saying here is effectively that you're taking an average, and as I say, it's the root mean square average of the two standard deviations, and you're using that to gauge how much the mean shifted between the two of them. Okay? So you can see that if the mean shifts by one, assume both samples have the same standard deviation for a second. If the mean shifts by one standard deviation from one sample to the next, then D is going to be 1. If, on the other hand, it only shifts by about a tenth of a standard deviation, D is going to be about 0.1. Now, we have a number. What do we do with the number? Well, what Cohen did was to say, okay, let's figure out what a small effect, a medium effect, and a large effect are. Let's put this in, you know, terms that we can more or less sink our teeth into. And I'm going to show you what those look like. So if you go to the next slide, you're now looking at a small effect size. And a small effect size, Cohen said, was around 0.2. Now, instead of giving you those textbook smoothed out curves, etc., I'm giving you actually some things that you might actually see with actual data, okay? So you might be looking here at some sort of exam score that tells you how well people did in the course. Alternatively, if you're interested in people taking, say, more chemistry courses, you might be looking at how many more chemistry courses people took down the road as opposed to how few chemistry courses, etc. But however this score is computed, what you're looking here is at a small effect size. The outlines reflects the original group. The shaded in portion reflects the one that had the modification, say the technology introduced for it. And here you're looking at what Cohen calls a small effect, which is D around 0.2. And to give you a rough idea, what you're looking at here is around 15% of the overall curves are non-overlapping. in these cases. In other words, these two are very, very similar. So you've only shifted by about 2/10 of a standard deviation, and that's not very much indeed. If you go to the next slide, you're going to be looking at what Cohen called a medium size effect. And now D is about 0.5. You can see now that there's less overlap between the two populations. In fact, we're seeing about a third non-overlap between the two populations. So now we have a more significant difference. The effect is more, is larger, if you will, in terms of the before and after, or in terms of the control versus technology group. Finally, to see a really large effect, go to the next slide. And now we have D equals 0.8, and that corresponds to almost 50% of the population being non-overlapping. In other words, these two curves fail to overlap in 50%. Now, there's a significant effect. It's a large size of effect, and that's telling you, okay, yeah, there's something really going on here. How to use these? My recommendation is not to get hung up on whether something is D equals 0.2 or 0.21. Rather, when you go back to that matrix and you say, am I comparing the two groups, you might find that, well, the experimental procedure, let's assume we're doing a simple compare the no treatment control with the experimental procedure group, right? And you might find that the experimental group shows a large effect size, something like D equals 0.8, but the other one only shows a small effect size, in other words, 0.2. So that is already allowing you to say, well, look, it looks like even though there was some effect of something going on, you know, possibly some type of expectation effect in my control, I'm also seeing a large differential vis-a-vis when I introduced the technology. By contrast, if you saw a 0.2 in both cases, well, it's not looking very good for that technology having had a significant impact on what you see at all. And again, the more elements you have in that matrix, the more comparisons you can make, the better you can apply this to say, okay, do I have significant expectation effects or not? All right, so sometimes you say, well, great, we've got this, and what should we do about it? Now, you know, if you're taking this seriously, obviously you want to decide, well, maybe A, this technology is not where we want to go. B, maybe you want to use it in a completely different way. C, maybe you want to do something completely different altogether. And you have to realize that I'm a strong advocate for technology, but I'm not a strong advocate for throwing technology at a problem if it's really not doing very much good at all. There are three pitfalls that I'll mention that I've seen happen sometimes, even after people have identified expectation effects, that I think you want to steer clear of. And they're very tempting, because let's face it, you've put your heart and soul into a project. You don't want to hear that it didn't do very much of anything because of the technology, but because of an expectation effect. So the first one is what I call the pitfall of equivalent exchange, and you have the phrase there, maybe it didn't help, I didn't hurt anything either. In other words, this is where you do the comparison, they come out even, and you say, well, okay, so it maybe didn't hurt, it didn't help, I didn't hurt, so fine, we'll just leave it be. Well, look, anytime you're introducing a new technology, there's a cost to the new technology. And inertia can be a terrible thing. So I'll bring up the clickers again, because I'm seeing sometimes that, well, I think the clickers can be wonderful things. I'm also seeing the clickers getting introduced just because they're interesting technology without much idea of how they're going to be used. And no matter how cheaply you're getting those clickers, well, maybe you're exchanging the fact that you're spending money on clickers for the fact that you're not spending that money on teaching fellows. And maybe the clickers didn't help but didn't hurt, but the teaching fellows could have helped. So that's the first one. The second one is to say, well, look, you always see expectation effects with new tools because of the novelty factor, right? It's, once again, it's a halo effect. Novelty, particularly in today's culture with today's student, always tends to have a positive connotation for the students, not always for the faculty. So therefore, you're always going to see this kind of effect with a new technology. Or if you notice a negative effect, well, you see it's because the faculty are overall negative, because overall with new technologies, faculty tend to be negative. Okay, folks, again, it is true that, yes, novelty has a powerful gravitation effect in the form of a halo effect. Absolutely true. But that being said and done, if your technology still has some real effect, you should be able to separate out the results for the technology from those for the halo effect. In other words, if in the effect size you're getting exactly the same effect size, look, it probably isn't there isn't that much to the technology. It's very unlikely that the novelty factor will completely swamp out any technological effects. And the last one is in some ways the most insidious one, which is the one that says, well, okay, so now we know the degree to which the tool was influenced by expectation effects, so we'll either use it or not use it, and that's all there is to say about that. But particularly with many of these new technologies, leaving the discussion there is not necessarily the healthiest thing to do, because sometimes you can obscure problems. And I'm going to bring this up in the context of content management systems, because I've seen content management systems sometimes be blamed for poor results with students and saying, well, see, it's the CMS that's happening, and then people do an expectation effect that's, aha, you see, it's the expectation effects that are ruling the coup, so, you know, we're not going to worry about it because the CMS allows us to distribute the courses more widely, so that's good enough, so that's it. Well, the trouble is that what you may have is a scenario where what the CMS is doing is taking away some of the expectation effects that surrounded an older technology, namely the lecture in the classroom. A professor that in person is very charismatic and may be able to get away with teaching the same lecture in and out with the same PowerPoint, not PowerPoint, sorry, with the same overheads that grow yellower and yellower each year as they age, you know, and get dirtier and dirtier from scribbling on them, right? Well, sometimes they can get away with that on the basis of expectation effects in the classroom. But what you've actually done is you've shorn away some of those expectation effects when you go away to a content management system, and suddenly those same overheads rendered as PowerPoints minus the presence of the professor makes for a dull, leaden class, and you've got a problem there that you need to deal with. So again, just leaving things be and assuming, well, that's all there is also a pitfall you want to avoid. All right, so that's it for the pitfalls. And the last thing I want to do is just take a very quick peek at the Horizon Report technologies. So go two slides ahead. And there you have a list of technologies. And one of the questions you might want to ask is, so which ones of these are more or less likely to be susceptible to expectation effects? And I'm not going to do the entire sequence. If I leave those as an exercise for the reader, especially for those of you who haven't read the Horizon Report yet. But I'll just point one that has a relatively low likelihood of expectation effects and one that has a high likelihood. Low likelihood, I would argue, intelligent searching with a proviso. Intelligent searching allows you to access information that you could not have otherwise accessed in ways that you could otherwise not have accessed. As such, it is objectively putting something on the table that students can use that they could not use before. So in that sense, it is a less likely technology to introduce expectation effects that can't be handled because you're looking at something that is very concrete. Either the student didn't have something and now they have it for, say, knowledge for an anthropology class, or they don't. But there's a caveat. The caveat is that sometimes you can create, halo effect appearing on the horizon again, the illusion of access to more information than there used to be. So some of the intelligent searching projects, in fact, can be susceptible to very high likelihood of expectation effects that overwhelm technological results if, in fact, they don't keep this in mind. In other words, if what you're doing is just creating more of an illusion of a richness of resources rather than the actuality of the richness of resources, you may still be getting good results out of it, but it's not a question of the technology, it's a question of the expectation effect. On the high likelihood, I'll point to educational gaming. The reason for this is pretty straightforward. Educational gaming tends to have a huge halo effect. Students like games Most students, not all, but most students like games. And therefore, anything that comes, so we say, with a game is going to start with a huge head start. So again, you may in fact see better results from the course taught with games than without. But if you look at the literature on educational gaming, relatively little of it has looked at expectation effects. And again, I would argue that you have to be very careful here, because while I'm a very strong proponent of gaming in education, I'll also point out that it can be horribly expensive. And if what you're looking at is a tiny little effect, once you subtract out the expectation effect that's really at the base of what's going on, it may not be worth your while to make that huge investment, and you might be better off spending it elsewhere. So when you're looking at the Horizon Report Technologies, I would strongly encourage you to think, what type of expectation effects might appear, why, how would you look for them using the techniques we discussed before, and what would you do about that? So that's it. So the last couple of things is, on the next page you have a bibliography, and I've tried to make sure I don't just give you the whole book in these cases, but actually tell you, okay, so which chapters of the book actually refer directly to what we've been talking about. And finally, on the last page, you have my website and my email address if you'd like to contact me. So I guess that's it, and I look forward to hearing what questions people have.
I've got a, Ruben, this is Wayne. I've got a comment or question, if I may. First of all, thank you. It was a good overview, I think, of what expectation effects are and things to look at. But I'm wondering, as we look more recently at our current students, and as they're being exposed more and more to technology, both in their personal life and more in their classes, whether they're becoming desensitized almost to the new technologies being offered, and are we seeing as strong these expectation effects in recent years as we did, say, five, 10 years ago? Are we seeing a trend that they're becoming desensitized?
You know, that's an excellent question. And I think the answer is, I haven't seen enough research to answer it for sure, but I can tell you some of what I've seen. And some of what I've seen does indeed point to some expectation effects indeed having a sort of desensitization factor. So indeed, the novelty factor, for instance, may be becoming less and less of an issue. And you're seeing that in things along the lines of students saying, well, you have this, geez, you know, I had this for years already, right? You know, we're very proud that we're using the iPod, and the kid tells you, well, you know, I had the first iPod, and I had the mini, and I have a couple of shuffles, and you're just beginning to play with this. So if anything, they're a little jaded about this. So the answer is, I think, yes. I think there are some desensitization effects, but I would love to see more research to make sure that that's indeed the case.
Well, just as a follow-up, well, we may be seeing a lot of these expectation effects is more in the faculty, because the technology perhaps is newer to them than it is to the students.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. I think you're absolutely right.
I was often, when I'm playing with a new technology on my campus, I'll do a very, very small pilot with essentially, in many cases, a proof of concept. Do you have advice for, and so what I hear you've described today is, are some excellent points to then take a proof of concept and try and communicate its value to a broader audience. But the shortcoming often is well, at least on my part, I am not. My concern is that my sample sizes are far too small. Do you have any comments about that?
Sure. In terms of sample size, you know, it's always a degree of how much explanatory power you're going to get off a sample size. So, no, you can't get the same explanatory power out of a class of 10 that you can out of a class of 100, but then again, the problems of a class of 10 are not the same as those of a class of 100. So my recommendation would be, whenever you're doing the, you know, these prototypes, these proof of concept runs, to say, well, okay, some things are not going to be feasible because they're proof of concept runs, but some are. So for instance, if you can design the proof of concept run so you have better historical information to compare it to, what I was talking about using the same evaluation tools, that can be very valuable, even if it's a small sample size. You can also use the diary technique I mentioned. In these cases, it's a question of what you're willing to give up. If you use the diary technique for a really small sample size and you ask effectively everybody in the sample to keep a diary, your explanatory power of the scores at the end of the run are going to be is going to be smaller. But on the other hand, if this is a prototype run for something you're going to do down the road, the insights you may gain from the diaries may well outweigh that problem. So that's the sort of thing I would keep in mind. In other words, saying within the bounds of what you can do in a small test, what can you do? The last thing I would mention is some people recommend a lot of small sequential tests. And again, the problem there is not that it's a bad idea. The problem is that resources sometimes can be a real issue. If you say, well, instead of just doing one pilot run, I want to do five pilot runs in a row, which effectively sequentially implement your matrix, that will work well. But, as I say, it can get pricey.
But excellent ideas for evaluating, I guess, the Technology Innovations Grant Fund that we have here at our school. How do we get some tangible and sustainable results from these projects? So thank you.